Thank you. It's beautiful. How many of you remember Darius from before, right? Yeah? Yeah. So Darius moved away to Sedona, but we forgive him, and he's back now, so that's a good thing. He lives in L.A. now. So, How about that poem that Hugh read? Beautiful, right? Kind of amazing with the bangles on the wrists of the ants as they do their magical work in the soil, and that spirit is aware of every blink of our eyes. There's so many miracles around us all the time, that we're born into this amazing universe that has things like hummingbirds who have a heartbeat of something like 1,200 beats per minute, you know? It's just incredible. And on the same scale, there's something like a whale that sings these mysterious songs in the ocean. Not to mention the ocean itself, and all of the stars, and space, and black holes, and light, and shadow, and everything that is such a miracle. With all of this being true, and I believe that it's true, I believe that reality is a miracle, why is it that sometimes we feel badly about ourselves? How is that possible? If we're part of all that is, sometimes we feel badly about ourselves. We're going to talk about that today, because I don't want anybody here to feel badly about feeling badly about yourself, okay? We're going to make sure that by the time you walk through those doors afterwards, you're going to understand a little bit about how sometimes we kind of stray off of the miraculous and sometimes think poorly of ourselves and also know a way out of that. That's my hope, and that's my prayer for us today. The name of this talk this morning is called Stepping Into Self-Worth. But really, it's more about, I'd say, staggering into self-worth or surrendering into self-worth. I was at a party last night. I went to my great-nephew's third birthday party. Shepherd is three, it said on the cake. With a lot of little three-year-olds and other children and a lot of their parents. And me, being the life of the party that I am, I asked people, do you ever feel like you hate yourself? Do you ever feel unworthy? Oddly, the conversation did not go very far. By the way, I didn't ask any of the children that question. I just asked their parents. The conversation didn't go very far, but there were a couple of people that were willing to speak to me about it, my relatives, I guess, and my sister and her son. And it seems like the overwhelming cause of feeling unworthy is something that I think Richard Rohr says so beautifully. Richard Rohr is a Franciscan mystic. He says that we feel unworthy because of who we are and because of who we aren't. And I would even bring that a little bit deeper by saying that we feel unworthy, as a general category, we feel unworthy because of who we think we should be and who we think we shouldn't be. Whoa. Is that a phone? Oh, okay. That was the voice of God saying amen and hallelujah, people. That's awesome. You know, I love it when cell phones go off. Feel free to keep your cell phones on. It's great comedy for all things. I hope you don't feel unworthy about that. You don't, do you, right? It's fine. It's fine. You are a delight. Your cell phone is a delight. And whoever that voice of Satan coming out of your phone is a delight. It was really strange. Oh. Yeah, that's right. I didn't used to think so. Oh, Hugh, you know me so well. You're going to have to go sit in the back, okay? Yeah. So I think the cause of unworthiness, or one of the causes of unworthiness, is again feeling that we should be something that we're not, or feeling that we shouldn't be something that we are, right? How can you ever win with that type of consciousness? How can you ever win feeling and thinking that way? It's just we're setting ourselves up for a no-win situation. But there's hope. What? There's hope, yeah. I was listening to Rupert Spira the other night, great non-dual teacher, a mystic also himself, that's I think borrows from the Hindu tradition quite a bit. And he was talking about this allegory that I'd like to share with you, but he gets all the credit for it because I think it's really cool. He was talking, the name of this allegory is called John Smith and King Lear. John Smith is an actor. John Smith is doing King Lear. Let's say he's doing it on Broadway, okay? He goes to the theater, goes in the stage door, puts on his costume, and does the first act, and he becomes King Lear. You know how they say that about actors? They actually became King Lear, but he actually becomes King Lear. After the first several acts and it's intermission time, he comes into his dressing room, and the director is so thrilled with his performance that it's so real and so true that he comes up to John Smith and he says, "John, it's amazing." And John says, "Who's John? I'm King Lear. And I'm not doing very well because my daughter's betrayed me. And the one really nice one I sent away to France, and I've been wandering around on a heath." A heath, sorry. And I have a feeling that it's not going to turn out well for me by the end of this thing. I think the daughter that I really like, actually all three of my daughters are going to die. And I'm probably going to go insane and howl and die too. And the director was like, "What is going on with you? You're not King Lear, you're John Smith." And he says, No, I am King Lear. I am King Lear. I am King Lear. I can prove it. See, I'm wearing this costume and I've had all of these experiences, King Lear. I am King Lear." And gradually, through drawing King Lear back to John Smith, the director convinces him that he is not King Lear and that he is really John Smith playing the part of King Lear. And he goes back and he finishes the act and he remembers who he is. Do you get the allegory? We were sent to this earth. The world is a stage and men and women upon it are merely players. I know I misquoted Shakespeare, but that's okay. The world is a stage, we are merely players, and many of us have been sent here to don the costume of unworthiness, of feeling like we're not adequate, of feeling like we're not good enough, a feeling that we should be something else and that we shouldn't be what we are. What is it like to acknowledge that just as King Lear is a product of the imagination of the author and the actor, what if these costumes that we don that are unflattering, what if they are also a product of the author and the actor, but they are not real? King Lear does not exist. Your perception of unworthiness, your unworthy, quote-unquote, unworthy self does not exist. But we make it so real. We put on the apparel. We become King Lear. Will you repeat after me? I am not King Lear.
I am not King Lear.
Good. We become King Lear, and then as we believe that we're King Lear, as we believe that we're unworthy, we start to look through this lens of unworthiness, and it seems like everything proves our unworthiness to us, right? I was talking about donning the costume of unworthiness. I came up with a little costume for myself here. Look at this. See this? Isn't that cool? Right? And I'm going to take it off because I'm likely to fall off the stage. But don't set yourself on fire, Bonnie. That was last week, okay? So, we actually don't see with our eyes, right? We see with our brains. And so we have this perception of unworthiness going in our brains, and that's why I said that whatever we look out and we see, it validates the perception that we hold. So if we believe that we are unworthy and we see what's out there, it affirms for us. We make up a story, we gather evidence to affirm that belief in unworthiness. Do you know that sometimes even when good things happen, we believe that we're unworthy? How many of you have prayed for something and wanted something really badly and then gotten it, and then you get it and you go, "Oh my God, what am I going to do with this? What am I going to do with this thing that I got? I'm not worthy to receive this." You know, we say that you have to ask and you have to believe, but you also have to learn to receive, right? I was trying to think of an example of this from my own life, and rather than talk about the church, you know, I didn't feel like I deserved this church when I got it, and I don't talk about the early days very much because people get mad at me when I call it the Church of the Corn, because that's what it felt like to me. But it was only because I was the minister of the corn. I fully acknowledge that. I was looking for evidence of my unworthiness to be here, and that's what I got, you know? So anyway, I'm not going to talk about that, even though I just did. I'm going to talk about something that was before that. something that my husband and I worked on together when we lived in New York, and I think the King Lear thing inspired the memory of this. When we were living in New York, I was working somewhat as an opera singer, and he's an actor, and I read the trade papers, and I saw that there was this play, a tour of a play that was going to Broadway tour, high-end tour, and they needed a part for a man about my husband's age, a woman about my age, and a cat. And we had a cat, and we were the right ages and the right types, and I said to Hugh, we're going to get this, we're going to get this thing, and we did it. We went after that thing like it was made out of ham or something. I don't know. It was amazing. We just totally went for it. We did The Secret before The Secret was even invented, right? I mean, The Secret's been around forever, but before the movie was shown, we did The Secret. We affirmed it, and we prayed for it, and we visualized it, and ultimately, after many, many ups and downs, we ended up getting the part. Hugh got an understudy of one of the leads. I had a very significant part. I had my monologue. Would you like to hear my monologue? Okay, let me get in character first. Good heavens! Thank you. That was it. Yep. Standing ovation over there. Yes, that was it. I didn't even do it very well. But anyway, and then there was the issue with the cats. We had to get a second cat, and we had a cat and the cat understudy, and I was the cat handler. So we got it. Hugh's agent told us that we pulled it out of the ethers, and this is magnificent. It's wonderful. It's a great thing. And then I started going, I don't know anything about acting. I don't know anything about cat handling. All of the other actors are better than me. Comparison, right? Very, very clear clue that you're in the relative. And so I started doing the work of affirming to believe that I actually really deserved this thing that I had now, this thing that I had. And really, in hindsight, without knowing this idea that the unworthy self or that King Lear is not real, I did the affirmations, that was one thing, but I also acted like King Lear is not real, like the unworthy self is not real. That's why we say, a word that we use for prayer here is treat, and move your feet, right? I call it living like the truth is true. You do the affirmations and you act as if the truth is true, the truth of your worthy self. And so what did that look like for this particular event that happened? And these are all things that we can all apply to our own lives. One of the things was the cat handling. I have to say, by the way, that Hugh felt completely worthy, and so did the cats. The cat, Julie Harris was the star, and the cat would scratch Julie Harris, and I'd be like freaking out and fretting and getting the cat back to the dressing room, running to the wings, putting a little Neosporin on Julie Harris, and then I'd come back and the cat would be there like, yeah, whatever. And Hugh would be standing in front of her going, are you insane? You just scratched the star. But anyway, where was I? Okay, so acting like the truth is true. So the cat handling, the company manager knew that I didn't know anything about cat handling, and he treated me like I was some kind of a dullard. At least I thought that's what he was thinking about me. Because, you know, you're making up stuff, what people think about you all the time. And as you're trying to get approval from people, it doesn't work very well. So rather than pretend that the image of unworthiness was real, I decided to act like I was completely worthy. And the way that we do that is that we surrender. We surrender. And we start to give away what we want. I wanted approval. I wanted validation. And so I started giving it away to the company manager. I did whatever I could to make his life around the cats and the handling and all of that stuff easier. So what that looked like, that I knew that I had him. I knew that I had him when we had to get the cats into Canada, and there's some paperwork issues with that. And he was fretting and stressing about how I needed to do all this stuff for the cats and get their paperwork in order, their health papers. And I said, I have the paperwork. I have a copy for both handlers. And by the way, I have laminated the paperwork and attached it to their carriers. Whatever we can do to give ourselves away, to give worth to others, to give validation to others. It's spiritual law. It's paradox. It helps us remember that the unworthy self is tiny, non-existent, in comparison to that place within us that seeks to give of itself always, and it is through giving that we receive. So is there something in your life, a place in your life, where you feel like you might be threatened or feeling less than, and is there something that you can give to the situation? Rather than asking, how can I get this person to approve of me? How can I get this life to validate me? Why not just let that go and give something? You see how that takes back your power? That completely takes back your power. If you're giving, you are in the driver's seat. You're in the place of recognizing that you are greater, the true you is greater than that thing that feels threatening to you. Another thing that I did when I was on this tour, again, without even realizing that I was doing it, had to do with the other actors and actresses that I was with. They had all done years and years of theater, years of rep in England, and lots of Shakespeare and all kinds of stuff like that that felt very intimidating to me. I'd been in some operas, but I didn't really know much about stage acting. And when that happens, for me, the first thing I want to do is lie. Like, they would talk about all this stuff that they had done, and I would pretend to know what they were talking about. Let's put it that way. Has anyone here ever done something like that? Okay. Oh, look at the people over there raising their hands. Okay. Good. Cool. You know, and it's so tempting because you don't want to be thought less of. If there's this voice in your head that says, if I don't know this, they're going to think I'm inadequate in some way, right? I've done that a lot. I've done that a lot in my life of you know. Let's just stop the confessional. Let's just say that I've done it a lot. Okay. Say what? Yeah, come on. Yeah. So what I decided to do instead was to be truthful and to have a sense of humor about my lack of experience and my lack of knowledge. I remember actually asking Hugh, you know, when the other actors are talking about stuff and you don't know what it is, what do you do? And he said, I prefer to be surprised. Meaning, I don't need to pretend that I don't know. You probably don't even remember saying that. But I decided to prefer to be surprised, to ask questions about stuff that I didn't know. And sometimes they would scoff and say, wow, you don't know that? And I'd be like, nope, opera singer, that's it. And it got to be comical. I remember I had actually been an understudy in another show, another Broadway show, and they were asking one of the scariest actresses, this big, tall British woman who had done tons of theater everywhere. She asked me, how come you weren't the star's understudy? Because I was an understudy for the smaller part, and I should have been the star's understudy too, but they didn't want me to do it. She said, how come you weren't the star's understudy? And I said, well, I think probably they wanted someone who had actually been in a play before. Yeah, my theater resume is very strange. It's like Pinocchio in third grade and then two Broadway shows, you know? Just fluke connections and being in the right place at the right time. So once I started doing that, I started cultivating a relationship with these people, and the approval was off the table. They opened up about their shortcomings to me, their perceived shortcomings to me. I opened up about my shortcomings to them. And it was just this beautiful, beautiful wash of humanity and realness and authenticity. You know, I think that's what happens sometimes when we're trying to prove that we're worthy, is that we block ourselves from our true power by refusing to become vulnerable. Again, that's another paradox. Our power is in our vulnerability. So if there's a place where you might be pretending about either something you know or something that you think you should be, but you kind of secretly know that you're not, what if you were just to confess it? What if you were, I don't know the numbers of the 12 steps, but it's like admit it, and then either make amends if you have to, or just confess it. Just confess it and see what happens. It's a beautiful thing. What happens with that admitting wrongdoing or admitting that you're wanting to make things up or that you're wanting to feel more important than you think you are, what happens with that is that it opens up space for what I think is the most powerful healing in the world, and that is self-forgiveness. Self-forgiveness. It is through self-forgiveness that, again, we step into that full self, the true self, and recognize that the true self is real, and the false self, the King Lear, the unworthy self, is unreal. Do you see how powerful that is to recognize that all of the unworthiness that you have put upon yourself, that this is unreal? You know, we think that self-forgiveness will give us carte blanche to do whatever we want, but it doesn't. It has the opposite effect. Once we move into self-forgiveness, we cultivate the compassion and the wisdom to either make amends if we have to take compassionate action if we have to move into a greater place of totality. And once we cultivate self-forgiveness, we also have the power to forgive others. To forgive others, because they are just us. In fact, they are us. We are all one being by the name of Spirit. You know, everybody, if you ever come to me for counseling or what have you, you can pretty much rest assured that I'm going to talk about forgiveness. Richard Rohr says that it's the central message of the gospel. I believe that it is the central message of, at this point, I believe that it's a central message of how we reconcile ourselves with the human and the divine. You know, the story of the Christ is not about this guy that was half and half, right? Half human and half divine. Fully human and fully divine. And Richard Rohr says that Christ is another name for everything. Everything. The ant with the bangles. The sunset. The ocean, the whales, and each of us in the spiritual center. We are that everything that is everything. You know, one of the things about forgiveness, too, is that it allows you to move through life with greater grace and greater compassion and greater understanding. I was speaking to one of my relatives the other day, and she was saying that she's in this very difficult situation, and much of the focus when we're in a difficult situation is to change the other, right? To change the world. And what if the true power, and I believe the true power, is in forgiving the self? Because once we forgive the self, we can be completely honest. We don't have to defend ourselves. We can just say, yes, this is what I am doing right now, and it is not who I am. So there's the honesty of forgiving the self for putting on a costume and pretending that's who you are, and knowing that we all do it. We all do it much of the time. So that's about it. That's about what I got. The three main bullet points are, anybody? I don't remember what I said. What?
We're not King Lear.
You're not King Lear. Yeah, you're not King Lear. The unworthy self is not who you are. We're looking through the lens of unworthiness, and we're seeking evidence, trying to find it, right? This is a nice visual. If anybody wants my sunglasses to take home with them, you are welcome to have them. We're not King Lear. And we practice. We act as if we are that true, full, beautiful, wonderful self. And that allows us to practice forgiveness and self-forgiveness. It allows us to confess when we are out of alignment, when we are making stuff up, and it allows us to give that which we wish to receive. It empowers us to do all of that and so much more. I'm going to close with a paraphrased version of an Ernest Holmes quote. It's funny that Bill read Ernest Holmes today, too, because I change his words around a bit, and I hope he doesn't mind, but you can ask him. He's in my office right now. This is "I Keep the Promise" by Ernest Holmes and Reverend Bonnie Rose. "I shall keep the promise that I have made to myself." This is the part that's me. "I may occasionally tell myself that I am poor, sick, weak, or unhappy, but I won't give these words any power. The false self does not exist." Back to Ernest. "In this awareness, I daily speak the truth to my inner soul. I will surrender. I will realign with the great cause of all life, truth, power, and action. And I shall whisper these things into my soul until it breaks forth into songs of joy with the realization of its limitless possibilities." This is for you. This is for you. This is your life. We can let go of the false self and we can break into the song of limitless possibilities. Is that cool or what? So cool. All right, let's do that now and let us pray.